In a city where the reputation is laid back, anger over homelessness beginning to boil over, the emotions behind a recall push in Austin. That's today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Did anything change as the result of last night's presidential debate? Bernie Sanders' status as frontrunner, putting some top Texas Democrats into panic mode. We'll hear from Abby Livingston of the Texas Tribune. Plus, a race in South Texas that highlights the high anxiety among some Democrats. Is the economy strong, or are the stories trumped up? How you answer that question may affect the vote in 2020. We'll follow the money and more when the Standard gets started, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 26th day of February 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Give me a T for Super Tuesday. In that case, it's T minus 6 and counting. I think last night's debate changed any minds. Did it change yours? Truly, if it did, we want to hear from you. Hear what you heard that made a difference. Tweet us right now at Texas Standard. It's a long-standing tradition for critics to pile on the media about how its coverage of the horse race tends to sideline the substantive elements of the political season. And if one were being done to the exclusion of the other, I think I'd agree. But right now, a case can be made that there's a very substantive issue baked into the horse race that may be everyone's responsibility to consider. In his remarkably lucid analysis in the Washington Post published this week, opinion writer Charles Lane explores why the rise of democratic socialism in the U.S. at a time when the economy seems to be rather strong appears to be happening. More on that substantive question of the economy in a few minutes. What Lane suggests is that for the past century or so of American politics, the two-party system served as a bulwark to marginalize other political identities, effectively co-opting the fringes before they could form into third parties. What we are seeing now, Lane suggests, is a shock to the body politic brought about by endless wars, trade-related industrialization, cultural change driven by social media, and a load of public anxieties. Instead of the two big tent parties absorbing the fringes appear to be absorbing the parties. If you doubt it, consider Republicanism in the era of Trump, or consider the existential crisis some Texas Democrats find themselves in. Abby Livingston is writing about something quite similar in the Texas Tribune. Abby is Washington Bureau Chief of the Trib. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what you specifically are talking about is how you have some establishment figures in the Texas Democratic Party in panic mode. Could you explain why?
Certainly. So I think as all your listeners know, the Texas Democratic Party has been a hard place to be for a lot of folks over the last 20, 30 years because it's been in decline. And outside of 2008, things have not been good. And then in 2016, it wasn't anticipated, but the returns were startling to Democrats and Republicans alike as the cities began to move toward the Democratic Party. And that was on steroids in 2018 under former Congressman Beto O'Rourke's Senate campaign. Mm-hmm. And so now they feel like they've got their footing. They're ready to make some advances deep into Republican territory in the suburbs and districts at the state and congressional level. And so there's been this, you know, burst of enthusiasm over the last year. And within the last week, a lot of these same figures are really starting to panic because they see momentum for Senator Bernie Sanders at the nomination, and they are terrified of how socialism and that label, whether Sanders embraces it specifically or not, mm-hmm. plays in the suburbs, and it could affect down ballot candidates.
So the idea here is that, and this is where the horse race becomes rather important, certainly on the Democratic side, Sanders has had a strong showing in Iowa, in New Hampshire. He surprised a lot of folks in Nevada. And so depending on how he does in South Carolina, he could be unstoppable. And the question is for Texas Democrats, if he becomes the flag bearer in November, will Democrats, what, go to the polls?
That's the question. Well, the argument from the Sanders folks, supporters, is he's got this enthusiasm that no one else can compete with, and he will bring new people to the polls
right.
who haven't voted. The more establishment-minded folks say, you know, that would be great. But we've also got to get, speaking in their voice, moderates and maybe even some Republicans to vote for Democrats who are upset with Trump. The main thing is they wanted this race to be about Donald Trump. And the fear of the establishment folks is it will become about socialism instead. And so the conundrum is, in November, if this becomes a really untenable situation, do Sanders supporters stay home if they're their guy is not the nominee? But on the flip side, do moderates and maybe center-left Democrats stay home if the nominee is Bernie Sanders?
Does it matter that, I mean, there are those who consider themselves to be Democratic socialists point out that we're not talking about Stalinism here, right? I mean, this is not the socialism of the Cold War. And I'm wondering if this isn't a sort of a generational thing that's going on.
It's absolutely a generational thing. And I'm sort of in the middle of the two generations. So I have some vague memories of the Cold War, but that is something. I remember in 2016, I spoke to some high school kids, and I said something about socialism, and it was just blank faces, and it dawned on me they didn't know what the Soviet Union really was or weren't familiar with it. So it is absolutely a generational situation, and I think we're seeing it play out with the reactions to Senator Sanders' comments on Fidel Castro as well.
Yeah, that was rather remarkable in the debate last night. There was a concentrated effort to talk about whether or not it was okay to say that certain aspects of what the Cuban regime was doing was worth noting.
Absolutely. And as I was watching that last night, the thing is most winning campaigns are usually about the future. And mm-hmm. I'm sitting there watching Democrats litigate Fidel Castro, who took power in 1959. And
right.
So I think this is also just somewhat of a continuation of, we just keep talking about the things that happened during the baby boomers' youth. And, you know, a lot of the voting public was not alive in the 1960s.
Boy, it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out on Super Tuesday. Abby Livingston is going to be tracking this for sure. She's Washington Bureau Chief for the Trib, and we'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Abby, great to talk with you. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
As we fast approach Super Tuesday, we at the Texas Standard are taking some time to examine what issues might influence Texans at the polls in 2020. Today, we're going to follow the money, from employment to education to businesses. We're looking at how voters think about the economy today versus back in 2016. For more, we're joined by Paul Kelsted. He is professor of political science at Texas A&M. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me back.
In another era, when a certain president from Texas was being challenged by a governor from Arkansas, I think you know the one, there was a Democratic strategist named James Carville who said, what wins and loses elections, when he was asked about that, he said, the economy's stupid. Do you think that the economy can make or break a presidential race?
It certainly was the case back in 1992 when James Carville said that, David, but recent research is showing that this is becoming perhaps less and less true. Voters who are judging the economy are increasingly viewing the economy through their own partisan lenses.
Huh.
So Republicans are more likely to think that the economy is doing great, whether it's doing great or not, as long as a Republican's in the White House. And Democrats are more likely to either say the economy's not doing great for everybody, or they're likely to credit the previous administration for it, and therefore not more likely to vote for the incumbent this time around.
So there's no consensus on whether the economy's doing good and who should take credit.
There's less consensus about that than there used to be. So there's a lot of research that shows that back in the 1980s and in the 1990s, during the Reagan's expansion and during the Clinton expansion of the 90s, people of the other party saw the economy as doing very well and were happy to give the opposite party president credit for it. That's become less true as we've moved into this more polarized era that we're living in today.
We're already seeing the president taking credit for creating more jobs, especially for African Americans, than any other president before. First of all, there's the issue of who actually takes credit for those jobs, but then there's the actual numbers. As you hear some of the president's claims, do they generally ring true to you or no?
If truth is a binary indicator, you'd have to say sometimes, but there's elements of truth to it. The economy is doing very well right now. It's impossible to deny. Unemployment among the African-American community and the Latino community and among young people is really at historic lows. And so those are undeniably good things. some of the things that Democrats point out is that maybe President Trump doesn't deserve credit for these things, and that they were trends that began under the previous administration and that have just continued into the current one.
So riddle me this, Professor. Why is it that if capitalism seems to be doing so well for so many, that democratic socialism now has taken hold, and especially among young people?
Well, we are at rather historically high periods of inequality in the United States, David, and there are a lot of people who have anxiety about what a catastrophic medical bill might do for their family. And there's a lot of people who are concerned about college debt and, you know, the high cost of college. So even though people have jobs, a lot of people still feel a kind of anxiety and a kind of vulnerability that doesn't make them want to necessarily give credit to a Republican politician who's saying, hey, the economy is the best ever.
We've seen a bounce back in the oil field here in Texas. Oil isn't the sort of dominant thing that it used to be in the Texas economy. We've diversified quite a bit since the old days. But I'm curious how you think that the economic picture here in Texas might play out in November.
It's very interesting that you mention oil, because the fact that oil prices are stable but low and that gas prices are very low is, of course, a very good thing for average consumers. We do a lot of driving in Texas and a lot of commuting, and our commutes are not quite as expensive because we're paying, you know, $2.15 for a gallon of gas. So things like that are very positive. Of course, Texas is still a red state. It's changing. You know, the Democrats are hoping to flip Texas blue, and just never know exactly when that's going to happen.
So in a sense, it sounds like November could answer a lot of questions about just how important the economy is when it comes to picking our candidates now and in the future.
I think that's right. You know, we'll see how much our blue goggles and our red goggles determine our perceptions of the economy and therefore our votes.
Paul Kelstad is professor of political science at Texas A&M. Professor, thanks so much for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
I like that turn of phrase, red goggles and blue goggles, mm-hmm. and how that determines what things, how we see the world. Hey, let's hear what Texans are saying about the world today. Wells Dunbar, social media editor, what are you seeing?
Yeah, lots of reactions coming in about that conversation about the economy and financial issues affecting voters this election. I'll be back with some of those later in the show. But for now, we're hearing from our friends and listeners about last night's Democratic presidential debate, the last before Super Tuesday. On our Facebook page, Josh Fredman echoes a complaint heard elsewhere online. Saw this a lot in my feed. The audience on this one is kind of weird, especially the Bloomberg fans who are cheering for him and booing for anyone who goes after him. Speaking to all that crowd interaction on a similar note, Ozzy Zion Nelson says, I would like to see a debate at this point with no audience present, not hosted by TV anchors, but by the League of Women Voters or other nonpartisan groups. Interesting conversation to be said about what the parties are getting out of partnering with these news organizations.
League of Women Voters, that's an interesting idea. Yeah, we'd love to hear what you think about this or anything else that's on your news radar. Tweet us, won't you, at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he's going to be joining us once again in about 35 minutes with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
Business and your money on the Standard. On Tuesday, the state's Attorney General, Ken Paxton, announced that Texas would join 38 other states in an investigation of Juul Labs, which manufactures those popular Juul e-cigarettes. The investigation will focus on whether Juul misrepresented the health risks of using the products and whether the company intentionally marketed to minors. The company released a statement saying that it plans to cooperate with the attorneys general and health officials who are leading the investigation.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Homelessness is an issue for every major city in Texas, but the debate over what to do about it now centers on the capital city. Last year, Austin officials relaxed rules about camping on public streets. Citizen groups and even the Texas governor spoke out strongly against the move. Here's Governor Greg Abbott last October.
If Austin does not fix its homeless crisis by November the 1st, I will unleash the full authority of every state agency to protect the health and safety of all Texans.
Since then, there has been raucous debate among home and business owners who appear to be the most vocal opponents of the change. Austin reinstated some camping rules, but resentment and anger haven't gone away, and neither have many of the homeless encampments. Some Austinites are petitioning for more changes, including a recall of City Council and Mayor Steve Adler. The Texas Standard's Caroline Covington wanted to know what it was about the issue that has struck such an emotional chord in a city better known as laid back.
For some, Austin doesn't feel like the relaxed, artsy city they knew a couple decades ago. The city's population has exploded in recent years, and with that has come big city problems. Homeless encampments on public streets have been part of that, and those encampments upset people like Claudia Cuccia. Ever since Mayor Steve Adler relaxed rules allowing the homeless to camp on the street, Cuccia says she's afraid to walk under the overpass near her house.
I have fear when I encounter the people. That's right where I live.
Cuccia describes herself as a conservative activist and is a home and business owner in South Austin. She says she's had enough of the trash left behind by the homeless. The feces, the needles, all of that makes her feel afraid.
I don't care what led to that. I shouldn't have to have them trash out my neighborhood.
Homelessness stirs complex, uncomfortable feelings in people. Here's audio from an Austin City Council meeting last fall where some of this anger was palpable.
Is we need to reinstate the ordinance we had. I was here.
I think it's not right. I'm very upset about the shelter in South Austin because it is within in viewing distance of an elementary school.
There can be all kinds of reasons for the anger. But John Jost, a political psychologist at New York University, says a person's feelings about homelessness have a lot to do with how much faith they have in one thing, capitalism.
Whether we think that the world and the social systems that we're part of are really fair.
Jost has studied how people view inequality in society. He says those who identify as conservative find it easier than those who identify as liberal to blame the individual instead of the system when they see a homeless person. In a study he published this year, he measured the body sweat and facial movements of study participants as they watched videos of homeless people. His findings? People who had faith in capitalism were less upset by the images.
Some people engage in a secondary kind of process where they think, well, they must have done something to deserve their fate. Maybe it's about alcohol or drug use, or maybe it's about something else.
Jost says it's a coping mechanism, and it's almost automatic. But views about the homeless aren't as cut and dried as one study. Claudia Cuccia says she and her husband have hired a homeless man to do odd jobs for their real estate company. She also chats with people at the encampments. But what she resents is what she considers bad life choices.
What I care about is them and their behavior, all their trash and filth and the human waste and the needles. They're outside of the norms and they don't care.
Otha Norton is someone who Cuccia might have thought was outside the norm at one point in his life. He was homeless in Houston after being incarcerated for 11 years. But that was about 15 years ago. Today, he's about to finish his master's degree in social work, and he also works with the homeless in Houston to help get them back on their feet. But before all that, he says he felt written off as a homeless man.
I went into a Burger King, and it was like 101 outside, and I just wanted a glass of water. And they said, no, you know, and get away from my customers. Don't ask my customers for anything.
At one point, Norton thought it would have been better to be dead or just go back to jail.
I couldn't get my foot in the door anywhere. Everyone was looking at me. So, you're African-American, you're a felon, you're a statistic. I couldn't get a job.
He was homeless for 2 years after he left prison. But from Claudia Cuccia's point of view, everybody's had difficulties.
You don't get out of this life without trauma. How about that? Anything that's been, anybody's been on the street, I've been there. I've done drugs. I've been a battered woman. I've been uneducated and not had a job, been able to find a job. So I know how hard it is.
She admits she can't understand what it's like to be a person of color or to have been in prison and to also be homeless. but she says she grew up poor and was still able to make a life for herself. For her, it's all about making an effort, and she still sees America as a place where you can succeed if you have the will. And this impasse goes directly to the heart of John Jost's research at NYU. He says witnessing homelessness can bring up personal pain for people, especially if it reminds them of their own problems. And sometimes that makes them hold on to their beliefs even tighter.
It might help to think that some of our responses are defensive, that to recognize that on some level, it could be painful for us for a number of reasons.
Homelessness can reveal cracks in the economic system that Kuchia puts a lot of faith into. She says it's an even playing field, the most fair in the world. But Joe says capitalism wasn't really designed to be fair.
The biggest defenders of capitalism in the early days were not making the argument that it was a fair system. They were making the argument that it's an efficient system. Capitalism is a great mechanism for creating wealth and a pretty terrible one for distributing it.
Gary King once put all his faith in capitalism. He actually used to call himself a cold-hearted capitalist. But that's changed a bit since he volunteered to be a mentor at Search Homeless Services in Houston.
Just sort of trying to transport yourself and put yourself in their shoes and challenge yourself on how you would survive. It's incredibly difficult to claw yourself back out of that.
King works in the energy industry as an insurance executive. He used to think he could write a check to a homeless organization and move on with his life. Now, he says it's unrealistic to think that someone can get out of homelessness without a reliable, supportive community.
Hearing some of the stories, you know, really, you know, shook me to the core. It made me realize, you know, we as a society don't really have that much of a safety net.
For Austin's homeless, that net is a state-sanctioned camp east of town. It's a large empty lot that was used for state vehicle maintenance. But now, it might become the location of a permanent shelter. Residents there who don't want that are organizing, and they hope one day to buy land of their own for a permanent camp. In Austin, I'm Caroline Covington for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose research has helped bring more than 90 cancer-fighting drugs to the marketplace. Patients can access national clinical trials phases 1-4 in their communities. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A new poll finds a majority of Texans believe access to quality medical care is not enough for a healthy life. Instead, they say social factors are critical. Elena Marks heads the Episcopal Health Foundation, which released the survey results today. She says about 40% of respondents say how much stress a person has is essential to their health.
It's interesting and perceptive that this large a percentage of the population understands that stress has an adverse impact on your overall health.
Other non-medical factors that affect health include income level and living conditions. The U.S. Supreme Court says the family of a Mexican teenager killed by a U.S. Border Patrol agent in a cross-border shooting cannot sue for damages. As KERA's Mallory Falk reports, 15-year-old Sergio Hernandez Huereca was playing in a cement culvert between El Paso and Juarez in 2010 when the agent shot him.
The agent, Jesus Mesa, was standing on U.S. soil. Hernandez was in Mexico. The boy's death led to marches and other peaceful protests in both border cities, and a demand from the Mexican government for the agent's extradition. The U.S. government refused that and also declined to bring charges against Mesa. Hernandez's parents hoped to sue the agent, arguing he violated their son's Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court voted 5-4 that they couldn't. Justice Samuel Alito, writing for the majority, said the court could potentially undermine border security by weighing in. In her dissent, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote that, quote, Hernandez's location at the precise moment the bullet landed should not matter one whit. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
7 small East Texas cities are facing a lawsuit over anti-abortion ordinance they passed. Texas Public Radio's Lauren Terrazas reports.
The American Civil Liberties Union filed the suit Tuesday on behalf of the Texas Equal Access Fund and the Lilith Fund for Reproductive Equity. The cities of Waskin, Naples, Joaquin, Tenaha, Rusk, Gary, and Wells have deemed themselves sanctuaries for the unborn in the last year. The city's adopted ordinances also ban abortion rights organizations from operating within city limits, labeling them as criminal organizations. Both the TEA Fund and the Lilith Fund advocate for the right to access abortion. The lawsuit claims the ordinances violate their First Amendment rights to free expression and, by designating them criminal, illegally impose punishment without a fair trial.
Lauren Terrazas reporting, and U.S. Senator Ted Cruz wants to find out what airlines are doing to contain the spread of the coronavirus. The Texas Republican, who chairs the Senate Subcommittee on Aviation and Space, has scheduled a hearing next week. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Earlier in the broadcast, we were talking about the struggle for the direction of the Democratic Party in the Lone Star State. One of the stark examples of this fight can be found in the 28th Congressional District. It's a strip of deep South Texas that runs from San Antonio down to the border cities of Laredo and McAllen. Henry Cuellar has represented that district for 15 years, and he's banking on support from establishment Democrats as he faces his first serious primary challenge. His challenger is a 26-year-old immigration attorney and progressive who argues that the incumbent is not bold enough. Texas Public Radio's Rinaldo Leaños Jr. reports.
Nancy Pelosi struck a confident tone in her recent visit to Laredo to stump for Henry Cuellar.
So we want this to be not only a victory, but a resounding victory.
Pelosi appeared alongside Cuellar at his campaign headquarters, where she told a small crowd that she, quote, assumes Henry will win, but we don't take anything for granted. The 7-term congressman has a long list of endorsements and a strong campaign war chest, including support from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and a political network created by the Koch brothers. His challenger, immigration attorney Jessica Cisneros, is backed by the Justice Democrats, the same group that helped Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez get elected in 2018. Today, Jessica Cisneros and her team are going door to door in Stark County to hear from the community about issues that matter to them. Cisneros meets Jose in La Grulla. He tells her the streets are an issue and that healthcare is too expensive. He has to go to Mexico for treatment.
Right now, my wife is in Camargo because one of her legs was hurting, and she said, I'd rather go to Camargo than here.
Cisneros says the man's concern about healthcare is something she hears a lot. It's also an issue that's close to her. Cisneros' aunt died of cancer several years ago. Cisneros supports Medicare for All.
I think one of the stories that impacted our team the most, and these are stories that we've been hearing since, you know, day one in the campaign, were people having to decide whether they could afford to buy food for the week or having to choose between their, you know, prescription medications.
Cisneros is also in favor of the Green New Deal and a $15 minimum wage. She says she's the candidate that can bring a better standard of living to the district. According to census data, about 24% of people in the district live below the poverty line. The race has gotten contentious at times. Cisneros has called her opponent President Trump's favorite Democrat because Cuellar has voted with Republicans nearly 70% of the time during his latest term. She also criticized Cuellar for voting twice in favor of spending bills that included money for the construction of Trump's border wall in his own district.
He knows that all of a sudden, every single vote, it's under scrutiny, and that's like, he's being held accountable, and that's something that he's not used to.
Cuellar defends his vote on border wall construction. He says he doesn't agree with President Trump on the matter, but says,
do I believe in shutting down the federal government? I do not believe in shutting down the government. I think that's a radical view to say that you shut down the government because you disagree with some part there.
He says he used his position on the Appropriations Committee to protect areas in the district from wall construction. Cuellar says he's proud of what he's accomplished in office, including the creation of the Texas Children's Health Insurance Program and securing more money for economically disadvantaged students to attend college. Instead of challenging moderates like him, Cuellar says the progressive wing of his party should focus more on expanding the Democratic majority in the House and winning the Senate.
There are some radical people on the left side that will attack me and will attack other blue dogs, Democrats, because we think a little differently and they want to get rid of us. That's why we have a Democratic primary here where they're spending millions of dollars from outside money because they feel that I'm not in their image.
Nicholas Kiersey is a professor of political science at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. He says, like most progressive candidates who don't take corporate donations, Cisneros faces an uphill battle. He says the true test for Cisneros to overcome Cuellar's backing and name recognition is whether her ground game has mobilized enough people ahead of the March 3rd primary.
It's about people stepping up, making those phone calls, going door to door, talking to ordinary people, having those conversations where they connect, where they listen to their stories, where they share their own stories. People are demonstrating their commitment to a different way of thinking about the world, a way of thinking about the world that's based on the possibility of change.
Cuellar has raised $1.7 million this election cycle, with his top donors coming from the oil and gas industry and the private prison industry, while Cisneros has raised $1.3 million, with money coming in mostly from small donors. If Cisneros wins the primary, the 26-year-old could be on the path to breaking the record set by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as the youngest woman to serve in Congress. I'm Reynaldo Llanos Jr. in Mission.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Despite some recent chilly weather, this winter in Central Texas has been one of the warmest on record. That warmth can upset the natural rhythms we're used to as plants and animals make out-of-season appearances. KUT's Mose Bouchel went poking around and came back with three examples of such.
Before we get to those examples, I want to give a little more info on this winter, because even though it's been cold lately, it's on track to be in the top 10 warmest on record. That's mostly thanks to December and January, which were 4.7 degrees above the 30-year average. Victor Murphy is with the National Weather Service. He says in those first 2 months, there was only one day when it dropped below freezing.
Which is pretty significant. That's quite a bit of warmth spread over quite a bit of days.
And it fits with long-term trends. Thanks to climate change and urbanization, Austin winter temperatures have risen almost 4 degrees on average over the last 50 years. That warmth brings out all sorts of living things that you wouldn't expect to see in the winter. Example number one, bluebonnets. This year, patches started sprouting up along I-35 in January, months before you'd expect to see them. In fact, a review of wildflower reports shows that in 5 of the last 10 years, bluebonnets have arrived earlier than usual. If you stop to admire the flowers, you might catch another unlikely winter visitor. Butterflies. Monarchs, specifically. Warm winters cause them to survive in Texas later in the season, says Chip Taylor, director of Monarch Watch.
In cold winters, they'll have 2 or 3 sightings along that Gulf Coast, Houston and all of those areas. And then you'll get a warm year and you get butterflies that are sighted, from Florida all the way over to middle of Texas or even into the San Antonio, Austin area.
The monarch's annual migration to Mexico already faces many pressures. Taylor thinks that continued warming, especially in their overwintering grounds, could one day end it altogether, leaving only small islands of non-migrating butterflies in places like the Texas Gulf Coast. And here's the last example. It's a sound I recorded just this weekend of Mexican free-tail bats. It might be a little hard to hear, but you can kind of make them out chirping under the Congress Avenue Bridge.
they shouldn't be here. You know, in March, that's when they migrate back here.
That's Wildlife Officer Sarah Whitson. She says the bats usually fly to Mexico or hole up in a kind of hibernation until the spring. But more bats have stuck around town the last several winters, encouraged by warmer weather.
Climate change doesn't happen overnight. It takes years and years to see the impacts. But as far as the beginning, you know, stages, we're seeing just more bats here during the winter months and not migrating to Mexico.
Whitson says the bats are safe here in the winter as long as there are enough bugs for them to eat. But she worries a sudden cold snap might end their food supply. If that happens, it could be what scientists call a mismatch. That's when one species emerges at the wrong time of year, while another species it relies on is dormant. Norma Fowler is a biology professor at UT Austin.
You can get plants that bloom before the pollinators are available. You can get birds that come north before the insects are out for them to eat.
Fowler says researchers are noticing more of these mismatches as climate change disrupts the seasonal behavior of some plants and animals. I'm Mose Bouchel for the Texas Standard.
Normally, that is when winter is winter. These times, like, you know, end of February, early March, about the time when a particular predator begins to emerge from its den. We speak here of snakes, and Texans know to use common sense around them, but it's what we don't know that has commentator W.F. Strong a little concerned.
Twice in the last 3 years, I've seen good-sized coral snakes in my yard. Both times, I relocated them deep into the woods nearby. Their presence troubles me because there are often young children playing in my yard. If any were bitten by a Texas coral snake, though they probably wouldn't die, they would be critically ill for a few days, and the antivenin they would need, if we could get it, would come in at just under 10,000 a vial. They'd need between 3 and 5 vials, so it would be physically and financially devastating. By the way, antivenin and antivenom are synonymous. You can say either or either and be correct. No one has died in Texas of a coral snake bite since the antivenin was produced in small amounts in the early 1960s. In Texas, one of the most interesting cases occurred back in 1966 when Boy Scout Randy Wooten was bitten by a coral snake near Fort Worth. There wasn't enough antivenin to treat him locally, but they did find some in Louisiana. The Air Force kindly dispatched a fighter jet to rush the antivenin to him, made the trip in 30 minutes, saved his life. Tim Cole, a herpetologist who owns the Austin Reptile Service, told me that coral snakes are not dangerous in the sense that they will not get aggressive with you in the wild like rattlers will. They are shy snakes, and they will seek to get away from you. He doesn't like the saying, red on yellow will kill a fellow, because he said it's wrong in two ways. One, thanks to antivenin, it's highly unlikely a bite will kill you. And two, there are albinos and black corals that break the rule. His best advice is to never pick them up. Teresa Schisk-Saling, a licensed veterinary technician who used to work at Texas A&M's vet school, agrees. She told me, coral snakes are unpredictable. They are gorgeous snakes, but deceptive in their apparent docile nature. They can turn on you quickly. They latch on and they won't let go, chewing on you to deliver their venom. And that venom, she said, is 20 times more toxic than rattlesnake venom. The only consolation is that the volume is small. A rattlesnake will inject you with about 800 milligrams, a full hypodermic syringe of poison in one bite, while a coral snake will hit you with only about 2% of that volume. I hope no evil herpetologist is trying to genetically crossbreed the two. Teresa is also founder and director of the Reptile Hospice Sanctuary of Texas in Snook. She and her husband have enormous real-world experience working with venomous snakes. Rattlers, she says, are the ones to worry about. Indeed, all you have to do is scan down the CDC records of snake bite deaths in the U.S. over the last 100 years, and you see that rattlesnakes are responsible for 90% of them. Even with that record, you're still more likely to be killed by a lightning strike than a strike by a venomous snake. Let us return now to the handy rhyme, red against yellow will kill a fellow, red against black, venom lack, or friend of Jack. Some anonymous herpetologists suggested a new version. Roses are red and violets are blue. Leave the damn snake alone. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. You can find his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served. Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm going to be checking in with Wells Dunbar in just a couple of minutes. Stick around.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Last week, 11 Democratic candidates hoping to challenge Republican U.S. Senator John Cornyn in November took to the debate stage for the first debate of the race to be broadcast statewide across Texas. They said some things that perked the ears of the person sitting with me here in the studio. That's because she is the fact-checker-in-chief for PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American-Statesman. Madeline Meckelberg, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
What I'm wondering is if there was something in particular that sort of got you wondering, wait a minute, is that a fact?
This happened to me countless times during the debate, as it does as I go about my daily life.
So you're furiously taking notes here.
Of course.
Give me a number one.
So we highlighted a couple different claims here, and before we get into it, I'll just say we didn't rate every claim on our Truthometer like we usually do. These were just claims I thought needed some more context, or maybe people wanted to know a little bit more details.
Okay.
So the first one that we have came from State Senator Royce West.
Right.
And he said, quote, "When you begin to think about our federal prison system, some 2.3 million people incarcerated at a cost of about $31,000 per year."
How much does it actually cost per person incarcerated, I guess, right?
So he was actually pretty close on the cost mark here. A 2015 estimate that we have on prison spending said the annual cost per inmate in the U.S. was about $33,000 every year on average per inmate. But what he needs to clarify here is actually his count of the people who are incarcerated. So the latest figures from the Bureau of Justice Statistics looked at 2016. The incarcerated population in the U.S. was more than 2.16 million, but not all of those individuals were in the federal prison system, as he said.
Right.
So at the end of 2016, there were about 188,000 people in federal prisons, 1.2 million in state prisons, and 740,000 in local jails.
What you're saying basically, though, is he got in the ballpark.
He did, but he needed to be a bit more specific when he's talking about these figures.
That's right. We got to be precise about this stuff. What else did you notice in the conversation, the debate last week?
The next claim that we looked at came from Jack Daniel Foster Jr., and he said, quote, 10 to 15 counties in the state of Texas are urban, the rest are rural.
How do you figure out which are urban and which are rural?
So on this one, we also didn't put it on the meter. I'm open to having a debate about it. there are a few definitions that you can look at here. I thought his estimate seemed low. So what I looked at first was the Texas Conference of Urban Counties. And of the state's 254 counties, 34 counties are a member of this conference. And counties can join the conference. They're eligible if they have a population of 100,000 people or more. Or if they're part of an urban cluster with neighboring counties that come up to that population level. So they might not independently have enough population to be classified as an urban county, but with others they are. So there's a little bit of wiggle room there. I also looked at the Texas Department of State Health Services listing of what's urban and what's rural, and they have 82 urban counties listed.
82.
So there are a lot of different measurements you can use here, which maybe he needed to offer a bit more specifics about what his definition of an urban county is, but these are the counts that we have officially.
There was another remark made by one of the candidates, something about taxes and how the richest are actually paying a lot less than they used to.
That's right. This is a claim that was from Christina Sitsun Ramirez, and she said, quote, "When LBJ was our president, the highest income bracket in this country paid 70%. Today, it's just 37%.
I think I know the answer to this one here. What did you find?
So when we look at the current tax rate, she's exactly right. They're looking at the highest income bracket, which is for people with a taxable income higher than $510,000 for single filers, $612,000 for married couples, and the tax rate there is 37%, as she said. Mm-hmm. We decided to look back at historical tax figures and looked at President Lyndon B. Johnson. When he took office in 1963, tax rate there was at 91%.
91%.
I know. Can you believe it?
That's pretty, that's up there.
It is. And the taxable income there, the highest bracket was people with an income higher than $300,000.
Of course, that was a lot more money, though, back in those days.
That's right. And then in 1964, the rate was at 77%, and then it fell to 70% for that highest income bracket for the remainder of his presidency.
Boy, a lot of people have forgotten those old days. Well, just a few of the remarks made during last week's Democratic Senate debate broadcast. Though there's a high probability we're looking at a runoff come Super Tuesday, the eventual winner will take on Republican John Cornyn for the seat he currently holds in Washington as senator from Texas. Something tells me there will be more facts to check in this race before it's over, and if that happens, Madeline Meckelberg will sort out the fact from the fiction. She's with PolitiFact Texas at the Austin American Statesman, and...
You're listening to the Texas Standard.
I like how she does that.
She's really getting good at that.
Yeah, she is. Madeline Meckelberg.
Second time in Texas. Second week in a row.
Second straight week. This could be a string. All right, so let's check in with our social mediator, Wells Dunbar. And what are you hearing from Texans about what they're interested in today?
Lots of interesting stuff, dovetailing off of that conversation we were having earlier about politics and the economy, how these sort of pocketbook issues are affecting people's votes going into 2020 here. Range of responses, really fascinating stuff. On our Facebook page, Randy Smith says, transportation and other infrastructure issues are holding us back. Tax structure favors the rich, not the working. 40 years of trickle-down economics is starting to catch up with us, he says. He adds that there's still time to fix this situation regarding infrastructure, but it's not looking like we're going to. He's not very optimistic, he says. The theme of taxes coming up a whole lot as well, and maybe not exactly the stuff you're expecting either. It's a wide range of responses. Luana Campbell says, we have started our own business and have paid more in taxes over the last few years than before. But she says, however, the future looks good and our economic situation is what I consider stable. We're trying to reduce debt and expenses, which should also improve things. I hear that myself, trying to do that as well. Leah Keese, however, says, I've never paid more taxes in my entire adult life. We've changed our withholding during the year and still get nothing back. And under Trump's change to the tax code, all the deductions we used to take are gone. There was, I remember quite a few changes to that. First rolled out last year, going to be implemented again this year as well.
You know, an odd thing about those who do itemize, you know, it's not just that the deductions are gone, it's that once you, and this is an interesting thing, and those who do the math sort of differ about this, but once you take those deductions that do exist, you still find that the standard deduction is actually greater than what you were used to
and
taking off.
And they doubled the standard deduction,
exactly.
But they also did away with some things, I believe your interest, your mortgage interest deduction. I'm getting into the weeds here.
Yep.
I actually find this stuff pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it is pretty fascinating. It is pretty fascinating. If not depressing, sometimes
exactly.
It just depends.
And just as to whether folks are doing better overall, range of responses to that as well via Facebook. Vincent Morales says, literally every aspect of my business is doing better. However, Jeremy Kripe says, I got a 25-cent raise at work. $1 trillion corporate tax break sure do trickle down, huh? Also hearing from folks about that debate last night and some suggestions on how to improve things going forward via Twitter. Nellie Anderson says, debate moderators need to ask smarter questions. She notes that Fidel Castro is dead. The Mexican president's last name doesn't matter, regards to that Amy Klobuchar controversy. And hey, let's hear more about the coronavirus. I know that is definitely top of mind for a lot of folks out there.
Yeah, the Center for Disease Control warning that we need to batten down the hatches and think about what we may all have to do if it becomes a major issue here in the States. We're out of time for the big broadcast. We'd love to keep hearing from you. We're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens. dolphin watching adventures, and more. Details at galveston.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.